to dissect one of the, probably the most favorite famous verse in Scripture. You can start that for me. There we go. We were using this to talk through with each other what it meant to pay attention to God's voice, to use this time period before Easter to not only talk about, but actually think a little bit about the practices that go into our quiet time with God. And so last week I approached you and let you think and meditate on Psalm 23. We did it in a variety of different ways, and I'm going to, in a moment, just reread the psalm for you. But what we're trying to do is sort out in our own heads how exactly each of us pays attention to God, how we listen to Him, how we interact with Him. And Psalm 23 is a great way to sort of think that through. I'm going to read it to you again this morning and let you again allow the psalm to speak to you not only as a bunch of words that communicate truth and theology and all those good things, but that it's also an emotional piece of poetry that God's Holy Spirit has used time and time again in the life of His people throughout the centuries in order to give them both confidence and assurance regarding their Christian journey. So let me read this again as you stare at the text with me. The NASB says it this way: "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside quiet waters. He restores my soul and He guides me in the paths of righteousness for His name's sake. And even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil, for You are with me. Your rod and Your staff, they comfort me. And You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. And You've anointed my head with oil, and my cup overflows. Surely goodness and loving kindness will follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever." One of the things that we realize is that God spoke originally not in our language. No matter how much we try to sometimes compliment ourselves that we were first, we weren't. This is English, and that's quite a ways away from that original Hebrew and Greek and Aramaic that was used. So our translations do their best to give us a sense of what the original says. So we use our translations in order to understand a language that none of us, or most of us, don't speak or understand. Contemporary English version says it this way: "You, Lord, are my shepherd. I will never be in need. You let me rest in fields of green grass. You lead me to streams of peaceful water, and You refresh my life. You are true to Your name, and You lead me along the right paths. And I may walk through valleys as dark as death, but I won't be afraid. You treat me to a feast while my enemies watch. You honor me as Your guest. You fill my cup until it overflows. Your kindness and love will always be with me each day of my life, and I will live forever in Your house, Lord." And then finally, in the Living Bible, some of you remembered this as a song. Most of the way that this English translation actually turned into a song that was very popular in the 80s. "Because the Lord is my shepherd, I have everything that I need. He lets me rest in the meadow grass, and He leads me beside the quiet streams, and He gives me new strength. And he helps me to do what honors him the most. And even when walking through the dark valley of death, I will not be afraid, for you are close beside me, guarding, guiding all the way. You provide delicious food for me in the presence of my enemies, and you have welcomed me as your guest. Blessings overflow. And your goodness and unfailing kindness shall be with me all of my life, and afterwards I will live with you forever in your home. As we contemplated that a little bit last week, we talked about what that means to us. And we talked a little bit about the whole experience of allowing that verse to speak to us, those verses to speak to us through a variety of different moods and temples and shades of our life. We even gave you a couple of different backgrounds to the verse. And at the end, I asked you which one speaks to you the most, which one of those backgrounds is how you identify this particular psalm. And the answer is, of course, that it very much depends on the season of life that we're in. It very much depends what's going on in our lives, because we make those kinds of relationships, we draw those analogies in our own minds. And so if things are fairly calm at the moment and you're perhaps thinking of abundance in your life, and there's a sense of praise and mercy and an outpouring of thanksgiving, this might be the idyllic kind of picture that communicates to you where you are right now. For some of you, it was more this the stillness, the quietness, the clearness of water that suggests something about refreshment, suggests something about where you go when everything is hectic and you're looking for some peace and some comfort. So this image may have stirred those kind of reflections in you, and then you make that connection. Or it could be in the last one, something very different, something that speaks of darkness, and yet there's that mood, there is light. It's not totally dark. And some of you, because of your circumstances, this is what drew you in. This particular image is what framed Psalm 23 the best for you. But that's one of the things that happens with poetry. That's what happens with emotion. Certain things draw us in. Certain things capture our attention. That's why when we do our devotions, there is great times of quiet, but there's also times of where music enhances our quiet time. There's time when being somewhere else, a walk in the woods, sitting on a beach somewhere, being off in a quiet place, where that enhances the experience of knowing God's presence. This is how we function as human beings. It's not just intellect. God instilled within us not only the ability to think, but the ability to feel. And worship and praise, so much of it is feelings and intellect working together in tandem. You have to know whom you praise. You have to know what he did. You have to know his character. You have to know and understand who God is in order to understand yourself. And all that knowledge will enhance your ability to understand and appreciate him. But as you merge that together with emotion, now come all the aspects of feeling. That God loves me. That he cares for me. That he feels I'm important. That he values me. That he wants me to value him. That there's a debt that I owe. And gratitude comes from the gut. When you really feel you owe someone gratitude, it comes out of you emotionally. Some of us do that very expressively. Some of us are a little more laid back. It doesn't change how we feel. We know how we feel. I was not a hugger when I started ministry. Hugging was not something that happened in my household. I didn't see a lot of hugging. I didn't experience a lot of hugging. And so as a young man walking into my first church, it was a challenge when people wanted to touch me. I was not used to being touched. And there were things that happened to me. I felt weird. It wasn't something that came now. Now, as I've grown older, marriage, having children, being in loving congregations that didn't mind touching me and were okay with me doing it back, that developed me so that my first reaction nowadays isn't, ah! I'm more relaxed, right? So there's growth that's available to all of us. But this expressiveness, some of you are just more naturally expressive. And so when you see the psalm, there's all kinds of dancing going on in your heads and in your hearts and in your minds. Others of you are reading it much more stoically and you're chewing on it like a cow with a good head of feed on, and you're just gonna lie there for 4 hours and shepherd, waters, right? And your head is just, your mind's going 1,000 miles a second. Others of you are just feeling it. That's how God made us. We're so different. We're so unique. There's no right way to enjoy Psalm 23. We talked a little bit about this. And this was kind of my Lent challenge. We talked a little bit last week about incorporating a little more silence. I threw it out there. I said, 5 minutes? Want to try it? I don't know how many of you accepted the challenge. You know, was it interesting? Was it good? Was it something you did once and never again? I tried to sort of lengthen it. And the more you're used to noise, the harder it is to be totally silent. The other thing I notice is that what I think of as total silence is never really total silence. One time this week, I went to find total silence. It's virtually impossible. There's noise everywhere. I drove out to Caldas Lake, went halfway up Teapot Hill and said, this is about as quiet as I'm going to find. And as I sort of leaned back against a tree and closed my eyes, a woodpecker started to peck. And I said, God, really? Really? Woodpeckers. Oh, silence is hard. It's hard to put that brain in that neutral position and then just be quiet. And like I said, there's all kinds of levels of quietness, but I do ask myself this sometimes, am I afraid of silence? Is that why I do it so little? Last week I introduced the fact that the psalm has 4 movements to it that we were going to discuss this morning a little bit that sort of help us with our thinking. And I left you with that image as you left last week. You remember that? And that question. This is a question that I incorporated in my devotional life about 10 or 12 years ago. There were many other questions that I used to take in. I found this question quite unsettling. This was a question I was challenged to ask God. And I found this a very unsettling question in silence to ask when I'm alone. What do you want? Because there's so many different ways to say and feel that question. What do you want, God? What do you want, God? What do you want, God? And I have said it in all those three different ways, sometimes depending on my mood and what's going on in my life. And it's intriguing to explore that as a question devotionally. I'll read something, pick something. Some of you, maybe you're following daily bread. Maybe some of you are following a Bible reading program or plan, and you're trying to get your way all the way through the Bible. Whatever your plan is, or it's just the, you know, close your eyes, open it, point at something. Whatever plan you're using for your regular reading, this is a great question. To read the question, to read the passage or the verse, and then go, what do you want? What do you want of me? What do you want me to understand? Oh, what am I compelled to understand or think or do with this? Let me touch on these four movements this morning. Help us to understand a little bit better how we can utilize silence, how we can do our devotions, so that in this period leading up to Easter, I said to you, this is usually a time when people examine their own spiritual relationship. The church always used this Lenten period in order to call human beings to an understanding of themselves, their interactions with other human beings, and their interaction with their Creator. And the church would do various things to remind people that self-examination and thinking through their relationship with God and their relationships with other people was a good thing. And then it would culminate in this incredible ceremony of Good Friday and then Easter Sunday morning. To hear his voice, what exactly does that mean to you? What does it mean to hear his voice? The first movement of the psalm delves into the whole relationship of the one who is shepherd and the people that are the sheep. I'm curious, when that is written down, what do you think? He makes me lie down. See, as a Westerner, I read it, and the English that hits me is that there's something compulsive that God does. He makes me lie down. It's really hard to make a sheep do anything, but it's particularly hard to make it lie down. When I read that, I sometimes thought to myself, oh, that's what it is when I have the flu. Right? Lord has put me down on my back. Now I'm lying in my bed feeling horrible, and he's making me lie down. There's no lie down command for a sheep. Hey, sheep, sit, stay, lie down. In fact, when you have seen any episode where veterinarians are dealing with sheep, they handle the sheep actually quite roughly. Have you seen that? They grab them by the legs and they flip them. And now they can shave them and do whatever they need to do with them. Right? You don't see them stroking the sheep. Come on, baby, lie down. Please, please. You don't see three or four people pushing on a sheep. Come on, down. You don't see that. It's just like, vroom, vroom. So when I read this, makes me lie down, I have some really strange images of what God is doing with me. Trouble is that, as cute as that all is, that's not what it means. And that's the problem with translations. They go from one language to the next, but because so much of it is imagery and so much of it is an understanding of background, and then there's the words themselves and what they mean, it takes a whole lot more to kind of understand what that is all about. What it means is that he settles me down. The word there means to settle something down, to create the kind of peace and calm that makes the sheep settle. And that makes sense, complete sense, within the context. This is the Lord, my shepherd, leading me. And as he's leading me, I'm eating. He's got these green pastures, and I'm eating, and I'm satisfied. And as I'm satisfied, I just naturally fold my legs in front of me, I settle down, and I contentedly lie there and chew. It's a picture of contentment. It's the sheep feeling so comfortable, so calm, there's no danger, there's nothing that's going to alarm it, and the sheep is like, man, I'm full, I'm happy, I'm just going to get right down here and enjoy myself. I'm going to settle down. He settles me down. What do you think that's about? He leads me beside still water. The curiosity is that this is not being driven to the water. He leads beside still water. The truth of the matter is that the sheep is kind of a weird animal, and it has a lot of insecurities. And one of the insecurities of a sheep is that if the water is fast flowing, it's afraid of the water. It doesn't really think that's water that it can drink from. So if you have fast flowing water, the sheep is kind of like, yeah, I'm not putting my mouth in that. That's way too wild. You got to calm that water down before I'm going to go there and drink from it. And God uses that imagery and says, you know, I lead you, and I lead you beside still waters. Waters where you can drink your fill and not be anxious, not be worried. Jesus always said that the sheep would hear his voice. If you pay attention, he says, you'll know that you belong to me. And I'm going to lead you to still waters. I'm not going to drive you. I'm not going to force you. I'm not going to push you. But you're going to hear my voice, and you're going to recognize me, and you're going to follow me. And a lot of us, that's part of the way in which we choose to follow Jesus, is we're reading his word and we're saying, just I want to sense that I'm following, and I'm doing it in a way that is acceptable to you. God says, on my part, I'm going to keep feeding you. I'm going to take you to pastures where you can enjoy yourself. This can be relationships. This can be answers to prayer. This can be quiet time. I'm gonna take you and I'm gonna shape you as you go through your life. But I'm gonna ask you to pay attention. And so part of the metaphor, the opening movement of this psalm, is the sheep that's hearing the voice, the sheep that's paying attention, the sheep that's allowing itself to be led, the sheep that is trusting that the shepherd is taking it into safe, right places. And the presence of the shepherd makes the sheep calm. That's the first movement, where we're to hear his voice. The second movement has a lot to do with the whole sense of trusting in the darkness. Trusting in the darkness. Paying attention to God so that even when I can't see him clearly, darkness disorientates human beings. we rely very heavily on sight. And our sight helps when we can hear. If you put those two together, we can navigate very easily with our sight and our hearing. Darkness is debilitating. It frightens us. Suddenly I can't see. If it's quiet and I can't hear, now I can't see and hear. And that lack of sensory input causes fear in human beings. Jesus chooses this purposely because those are parts of our lives. We experience darkness, times when we can't see. We can't see him, we can't see his will, we can't figure out the plan, we can't sense in the normal way that we were content before. All of a sudden everything is unsettling, and darkness does that to us. Life is full of valleys and full of disappointments and tragedies, and when you're in that valley, you're in deep. And the confidence to know that even in darkness, it's only temporary. He's going to lead us through the darkness into what is beyond. That is part of the imagery that he uses in Psalm 23 to reassure us. Even though I walk through the deepest valley, I will fear no evil. You are with me. That's all you need. And that sense that he's with me, even in darkness, was an important thing that God wanted to communicate for us. Sheep don't have great defense. There's no such thing as a ninja sheep. They don't exist. There are a lot of animals that you're afraid of when they are angry or hostile. I know exactly what the bear is going to do. He's not going to nuzzle me to death. He has claws. He has teeth. I'm afraid of the bear when the bear is agitated. An agitated sheep, that's just funny. That's just funny. Now you put 20,000 of them together coming at you, that's not so funny. But they have no real natural defense mechanisms. They are heavily reliant on whoever is in control, whoever is taking the lead. We have many times in our lives when darkness almost seems to overwhelm us. That's why so many people quit Jesus at a time of darkness. They can't see anyway. They're disoriented. They're unhappy. This is not what they expected out of life. God has done this to them. And in that darkness, and without any natural defense mechanisms, they feel abandoned. And their sense of abandonment, they then take out on God and they say, that's it. If this is what life is like, even when I believed in you, then I quit. And you'll find a lot of people that walked away that quit when it got dark. Huh? You know some. When personal darkness hits, that's a time when a lot of people re-examine their faith and say, and precisely for that, he says, I'm with you. I'm with you. Even though I walk in darkness, I'm with you. I'm there. That's the consolation. Pay attention. Stay with me. You have no idea where you're going. Stick it out with me. I'm going to get you through that valley. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, in the former Soviet Union, was a devout communist and famous literary figure in the 1930s and 40s in Russia. In 45, he made a negative comment about the leader of Russia, who was Joseph Stalin at the time, a total megalomaniac, and he made a negative comment about Stalin, and as a result, he found himself sentenced to a Soviet labor camp. And he wrote about the horrors in that gulag, that Soviet labor camp, One of the great nonfiction books of the 20th century called The Gulag Archipelago, on one of the prison labor camps around the Soviet Union. And he writes about how in that place he gained a greater understanding about himself. When he was a young man, he says, he was very judgmental towards people. He recognized after he was in the camp that he was a bit of a snob when it came to other people. He looked down on other people when people weren't what he considered to be as good as him, or working as hard as he could work, or thinking the way that he could think, or doing the things to change their life and their circumstances the way that he thought life could be changed and determined. He looked down on them. He said, there was an arrogance in me when it came to other people, other human beings. He said, I was not forgiving of people. I realized I was a very harsh man. He goes on to say, I was cruel actually towards others because I felt I was infallible. But as I lay there on the rotting prison straw, my heart got stirred. And he talks about being led to faith in that gulag, seeing those horrible things, and yet coming to trust Jesus Christ by the witness of a Jewish believer, a man who was later beaten to death by prison guards. But while he was suffering unjustly, thinking he was never going to get out of that prison, he found grace in that strange, awful, dark place. Alexander found grace. Here's what he wrote. This is why I turn to the years of my imprisonment, and I sometimes say to the astonishment of those around me, bless you, prison. I nourished my soul there, and I say without hesitation, bless you, prison, for having been in my life. Looking back later on, a very different perspective of the darkness that he had to go through. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil because you are with me. That's where he found life. One of the great comforts in the shadows is that the psalmist says that the shepherd has a rod and a staff. That has always fascinated me because I always saw the staff as being all that's necessary for the shepherd in order to control the situation. I always saw the shepherd as the crook where he could control the sheep and move them around or snag them. But I also saw the other end of the staff as something that the shepherd could use to defend the sheep. The truth of the matter was, against some of the violent predators of the time, the rod was a much better protection device. And so a good piece of iron in your hand was way more effective than a piece of wood. And so the shepherd is given a rod and a staff, a defensive and an offensive weapon by which to secure the sheep. Yes, he's gentle, guiding me when I make all the wrong moves. But he's not akin to smacking those that he feels would make my life too tough. God is not against disciplining for my sake and his sake. Sometimes, even me. You're paying attention. Your staff, your rod, they comfort me. Why? Because it tells me he's in charge. If I'm a sheep and I am looking at my claws, I'm not seeing anything. If I'm looking in the mirror and I'm doing the bear face as a sheep, I'm just getting the giggles because there is nothing frightening about a sheep's teeth. But the shepherd with a rod and a staff, that is one fearsome competitor. And that's what he wants me to have. He wants me to have trust in the one that's leading me. I have very little confidence many times in myself. But he wants me to have confidence in him. I do a lot of stupid things. I don't know if any of you do stupid things, but I do stupid things. And that's the lovely thing about having him in charge. And that's why I need to pay attention. Because when I don't pay attention, I mess up. Sheep are curious that way. They can be dumb as a post when they got something on their minds. If they're determined to go down a path in order to find some better food, or because they're curious and they always want to walk, they will walk over an edge. They will get themselves in all kinds of trouble. They will separate from the herd and be out there alone just because something got into their head and they just started and just following their own thing until suddenly they're alone. I know none of you are like that. I know it's just me, right? That's not an indictment of any of you. That's just me. I'm stupid. Right? Sometimes you get your head down and you got your own bit between your teeth and you got your desires and what I want out of life and what I want to do and how the world should work. And next thing, I can end up in a path of unrighteousness, which is why this next part is so important. In the third movement, he switches metaphors to a banquet table and he focuses on us receiving love. Says, you prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil and my cup overflows. What does that mean? What does that mean? I love the phrase, in the presence of my enemies. I used to get that wrong too. I used to think that what he was saying was, this table, everybody who's sitting at the table, some of them are my enemies and some of them are my friends. I used to think the table was also full of enemies. That's not what it says. You see, the banquet table is, he's got a table prepared, and there's invited guests, each who have a particular seat, and who are going to come and sit and enjoy the table. And then there's the people in the shadows, in the background. There's people watching the scene, and they're not happy. They're not happy that there's a table for me. They're not happy that I'm claiming that I have a seat at that table, that I didn't earn my seat at that table, that it was given to me, and that they could have a seat at that table if they were willing to accept the invitation of the owner of the table. But they witness the table. There's people that don't like us, people that maybe even hate us, people that will never forgive you for the things you've done, things that you've said. Their opinion of you is going to be negative until the day you die. I know that's true. Some of you have done things that are unthinkable. Some of you have done things that are unmentionable. David did some horrific things. I like the fact that David wrote this psalm, because I don't like David on a lot of days. He's one of my least favorite people in the Bible. I don't like David. Probably because he reminds me of humanness. I wish he was stronger. I wish he had a better family. I wish he was more righteous. I wish he could say no to women more easily. I wish that he was a better father. I wish all those things. And as I go down the list of all the things I hate about David, you know what? I think I know why I hate him. Because I think he reminds me of me. Must have been tough for David to imagine himself at this table. There's a lot of voices that would have said to David, you don't deserve to be at that table, you bum. What gives you the right with your never-ending catalog of sins and unrighteousness and ugliness, you failure of a man, what gives you the right to sit at that table? That's a clean table. You're a dirty man. Most of us have those kind of negative images and messages in our head over and over again. So a lot of stuff going on up here that makes us all believe we're unworthy. We can't do something. Wrong messages like, you don't matter. You don't have a table set for you by God. You're stupid. You're unimportant. You're not perfect enough. You're wrong a lot. You're not to be trusted. All those voices in your head telling you, you can't be there. And he says, rubbish. You prepare a table before me. The presence of all who don't like me. You anoint my head with oil. That's the signature of blessing. This is what God did when he said, this person is special to me. The anointment with oil was always God's way to say to people, this person's special. I've anointed your head with oil. Yours. You get to be there. You have every right to be there because of what Jesus Christ did for you. Your shepherd guarantees you a seat at the table. Your God guarantees you a seat at the table. Stop listening to the voices. This is a great movement in Psalm 23 when I'm urged to receive his love. One theologian defines grace as simply the two words, you matter. You matter. That's what grace is. You matter to God. That's why he took action. So, you stupid sheep, sit! You sheep with all those weird messages in your head. You sheep who think you're unworthy. You sheep who think you don't deserve to be at this special table that God is going to prepare for his special people. And it's going to be there forever. This analogy, this metaphor, this beautiful picture where it's just people sitting around a table and they're there by invitation and they have a right to be there. And God says you matter. And that's why I've invited you to this table. And it's your special place because you're special to me and you're going to be with me forever. Sit. Sit. Receive his love. Last one I'm just going to leave with you very, very quickly. Pay attention to beauty. At the end of the psalm, he invites us to beauty. Surely goodness, or as it's originally translated, beauty. Surely beauty and love will follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. See, shepherds would often have assistants in the back. When they were out front leading the flock, they also needed to be sure that something didn't attack from the back, and they would have assistants, shepherds in training, often young men who wanted to be shepherds one day, and they're at the back. In later days, as we understood the skill of the dogs like sheepdogs, they ran the back so that the back of the pack was protected. Love will follow me all the days of my life. God says, I got your back. You're following me, and you don't know what's out there, so I want you to know I'm not only out in front of you, I'm your rear guard. I'm the rear guard as well. I'm following. And what's following you is beauty and love. What do you see more easily? What do you see more easily, beauty or ugliness? It's very much based on our personalities. And one of the things that God is saying to us when he's talking about looking back is that so the farther I walk in my life, now I can look back and I see things I never saw before. I see incidents that happened to me in a totally different light. I reinterpret his presence because I know how it's brought me to this moment today. So I view the backward glance is different to me now. And I try and keep that in my head when things are just barely in the rearview mirror and I say, Matt, you got to be patient. 10 years from now, 15 years from now, 20 years from now, you will look back and you will see beauty, because right at the moment, right now, sometimes all I see is ugliness. Are you like that? It's easy to see ugliness. It's easy to see wrong. Especially right at the moment. I don't know what's going on in you today. I don't know if any of you are in your darkest valley or just coming out of one or just about to go into something. But I can promise you that if you can train this muscle to look back, not in regret but in thankfulness, if you can train that muscle, it will improve the journey. We can all use help doing that, looking back, not in regret, but in thankfulness. That is a tough sell, especially the way some of us still carry the past on our shoulders. Looking back takes moments of clear reflection. Let me pray with you as we think that through a bit. Father, this is one of the reasons that you stop us sometimes in our tracks. This is why you remind us to find you in silence. This is why sensory deprivation can be a good thing when our mind is in overdrive, when there's too much of a hubbubaloo going on around us. It's when we stop for a moment, especially as we look back, that you can do your very special work of graciously reminding us to be thankful, especially when sometimes all we see is ugliness when we look behind us. Father, you have used this psalm through countless centuries, generations of people. You've used this psalm so much when people are suddenly forced to look at you and at their own mortality, when a loved one is dying or when they are facing death. You've used this when people's lives have gone off course, when they are stuck and they're unhappy and they don't know where you are, and they're terrified about being alone. You've used this on the lips of others to encourage people to stay focused on the fact that there's a shepherd. Whatever and however you've used this, you continue to use this great psalm in our lives, and we bless you for it this morning. We ask you to call us to a strong sense of commitment to you as our shepherd, to listen to you, to pay attention, to see how you guide, to understand how to receive your love, and how your command to sit at the table is a reminder of what we're worth to you. And we thank you again, as we've celebrated this morning, for the unspeakable gift of grace through Jesus Christ, who died for each one of us. Thank you. Thank you that you took the price of sin and pain so that we could have freedom and eternal life. We bless you and we thank you. In Jesus' name, amen. I'm going to get you to sing a little